From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this show on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Within months of Oklahoma's public school teachers' historic walkouts over Republican-led austerity measures that have impoverished them, teachers flocked to run for state-level office and won big. In the state's primary in late June, voter turnout was at a record high. And of the 100 or so teachers and school administrators that ran for office, a whopping 55 made it past the primary races, unseating at least six incumbent Republicans. An August 28th primary runoff will determine how many will make it to the November general elections. The teachers are buoyed by the political power they exercised to win wage concessions. But the recent Supreme Court decision on the Janus versus AFSCME case, which was made on partisan lines, was a blow to public school teachers' unions. Those educators who see the value in their union membership rallied in cities around the country after the ruling to say they're sticking with their union rather than opting out of paying dues. My guest is Kevin Kumashiro, former dean of the School of Education at the University of San Francisco. He's a leading expert on educational policy, school reform, teacher preparation, and educational equity and social justice. He's also our education correspondent. Welcome back to the program, Kevin.
Thanks for having me, Sonali.
So several education-related stories to discuss today. We'll start with the Oklahoma one, the primary race in late June. This particular story at the state level got some attention, but maybe not as much as it deserves. Lost in the excitement over, you know, the Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez win in New York and Ben Jealous's win in Maryland was this story about Oklahoma teachers. Were you surprised? And how often does this even happen, that, you know, activists run for office in such large numbers and win?
I was so thrilled to see it. And it was a surprise to me. I actually hadn't heard that so many teachers had run in Oklahoma. And so it's very exciting to see the victories. And I think there's at least two things that stand out for me from this, from not only the numbers running, but also the numbers doing well in the primaries. So one thing that stands out for me is a redefining of what it means to be a teacher, or maybe more specifically, a kind of an embracing of the notion that teachers are more than just classroom instructors who follow what someone else says they should be teaching, right? That teachers are actually public servants. They're central to democratic processes. And that means that we not only need to be aware of the broader political context, it also means we're a part of it. And so teachers, like any other engaged citizens, should be involved in policy making, in decision making, and in the government. And I think that, you know, it's such a contrast to so many reforms that are about deprofessionalizing teaching and are about making teaching only about following a script or teaching to tests. These are teachers who say our work is actually about improving education, and we connect the dots about what it means to actually do that. And I think relatedly, the other thing that this the elections point out to me is really the power of organizing and the challenges actually to what has become very contemporary union strategies. I was looking at this piece recently by economist Richard Wolff, who reminds us that back in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, union organizing was really about grassroots campaigns, it was about political education, it was about consciousness raising to get people to kind of connect the dots about different injustices at play in labor and businesses. And what we saw, what he tells us, is that what we saw in the last half a century is that unions became much more compromising to try to make gains. And we saw a shift with that with places like the Chicago Teachers Union. When they went on strike, they took a very different strategy. But in these six red states that you mentioned that had the teacher walkouts, the strikes back in the early part of this year, and Oklahoma was one of them, West Virginia was the first, these are states that actually have not only weaker unions, because the state laws prohibit collective bargaining, but also they have unions that sometimes went against what the teachers wanted to do. The teachers were more radical, in other words. And so it's exciting to see teachers organizing in ways that are about connecting the dots and pushing for a much more bold and democratic vision of what education should look like.
Kevin, do you think that the order in which things happened played a role? That is, that the massive strikes, they were technically walkouts, that took place not just in Oklahoma, but in the states around the country, happening first, and then those walkouts actually resulting in wins, prompted this desire by so many teachers and educators to get involved in the political system through the electoral process, that you wouldn't have seen this kind of engagement through elections were it not for the kind of, you know, civic engagement on the streets, that kind of street level protest that actually paid off.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think on two levels. One is that the teachers themselves, when you read media coverage, are saying that, you know, one of the really big reasons they're running is that they were so disenchanted by what they learned was going on in the state legislature, right? They just saw so many of their elected leaders not being supporters of public schools or of public educators. So I think that incentivize the teachers to run. But I think there's another really important takeaway here, which is that the public, right, when you look at the polls in places like Oklahoma, well, I've only looked at the polls in Oklahoma, but when you look at the polls in Oklahoma, education rises up as one of the really big concerns of the voting public, not just of educators, which I think is why teachers and leaders running for office gets a lot of attention. And why is the public so interested in education? I think it's because of the messaging that the teachers used when they were protesting, right? In the buildup to the walkouts and during the walkouts and arguably after the walkouts, many states, as time went on, you know, especially after West Virginia, the messaging became that focused not only on teacher compensation. People were not only saying teachers are underpaid and they have to work four jobs. They were saying that, but they were going beyond that. They were saying this is emblematic. This is, what am I saying? It's the tip of a much larger iceberg where schools are being grossly underfunded. And that's the bigger problem that we need to be pushing for. I think that framing helps people to see that, there is something really wrong with education and there's something wrong with the government that's allowing education to break down as it is.
And so what role in Oklahoma, but also in other states, did the public teachers, public school teachers unions play in these walkouts, right? I mean, because it's union power that binds teachers together, that shows them that they have collective power. So the first part of the question is, what role did unions play? And then the second is, now with the Janus decision in the Supreme Court, how much is that power going to be corroded?
Yeah, so this is an interesting moment, especially with the walkouts that we saw earlier this year, because all six of those states don't have collective bargaining laws, right? So unions are actually greatly weakened. And if I'm not mistaken, all six of those states also don't have agency fees, which I'll talk about in a moment when we come to the Janus case. They don't have the right to have union representation negotiate contracts. And what I think that, and therefore they don't have the right technically to strike. What I think that did is it means that a lot of these states don't have states without collective bargaining laws tend to be the states with lower teacher compensation. I mean, you know, it's not surprising, right, that where you don't have the right to organize in the form of unions, you're not going to have as good job protection and compensation. But interestingly, these states also, we saw a trend where the teachers who were organizing sometimes spoke against what the unions were calling for. And Oklahoma is actually one of these situations where Oklahoma's union was calling to compromise and settle. And there were a lot of teachers on the streets who were angry and saying, no, actually, we should continue the walkouts. We should be pushing for more. And I think this goes back again to what I was saying earlier. You know, I used to work at a union. I'm a big fan of unions throughout the 20th century being forces for democracy and civil rights. The problem is that unions don't always operate in that way. And the trend in the past half a century was much more towards compromising with power structures rather than pushing a more aggressive agenda. And I think that's why the teacher walkouts were so breathtaking, is because some of them operated outside of and sometimes even against organized union, organized labor. Now, the Janus decision is so interesting, right? And I know you already covered this and your viewers are probably familiar. The Janus decision that the Supreme Court just decided affects public sector unions, so, you know, paid by the government, by the public sector. But it basically says that public sector unions cannot mandate the paying of agency fees. So agency fees are different than the full dues. They're usually, well, they're always less than a full membership due. And the distinction comes when you kind of break down what a union does, because unions sometimes do policy advocacy and campaigning and stuff like that. And people were like, well, I shouldn't have to pay to support a union that campaigns in ways I don't agree with. And so the courts have actually agreed. What they said is, all right, you don't have to pay full membership dues. But in the past, according to the 77 Abood Supreme Court decision, the Supreme Court actually decided that you still, though, can be mandated to pay what's called agency fees, which are basically fees that cover the cost of a union to do what covers everyone, whether or not you're a member.
Right. It takes money to run a union, obviously.
Exactly.
The brick and mortar buildings and the salaries of the union representatives, the people. Yes, of course.
Exactly. And the union staff do things like they help negotiate the contract that you are benefiting from, whether or not you're a member. And they protect you in grievances and arbitration, whether or not you're a member. So those are two really big things, right, that everyone benefits from, whether or not you're a member. And it's because of the unions. So you should have to pay what's called agency fees. That's what the Supreme Court decided back in 1977 under the Abood versus Detroit Board of Education case. So just a little bit more background, by the way. 2 years ago, we had the predecessor to today's case. It was the Friedrich versus California Teachers Association case. And it was basically the same case as what we just saw with Janus. It was teachers mobilized by a conservative political organization, a conservative advocacy group, mobilized a bunch of teachers in California to say, we shouldn't have to pay agency fees because even that violates my free speech. And the court, because we only had 8 members at the time, had an even 4-4 split, and so it went nowhere, that the lower court decision stood. But the case came back under Janus, and that's the decision that we just saw. Same argument, right? We shouldn't have to pay agency fees, it violates my free speech. And in a 5-4 decision, the Supreme Court decided, yes, you shouldn't have to pay agency fees. Now, how does that affect unions? Well,
And we should add, it's not just public school, you know, K-12 teachers unions. We're talking about state university unions that include academics, et cetera. Yeah.
Absolutely. It's public sector unions. And we shouldn't be surprised if another court case comes up that affects private sector unions as well. But, you know, the big teacher unions, the National Education Association and the American Federation of Teachers, they have already said that they've anticipated that a conservative court is going to rule this way and that it will really, really kind of decimate their membership. 10% maybe loss, which translates into tens of millions of dollars. So how that's going to affect unions, well, I think it's more important maybe to ask how that's going to affect public education, right? With weaker unions, are they going to be able to protect teachers? Are they going to be able to advocate on behalf of public school children? I think that's really what we now need to brace ourselves for, is the aftermath of this decision.
And how have teachers rallied after the Janus decision? Was there a big showing? I know that was expected, as you said, so people weren't surprised, but I know that there were plans to have rapid response protests in cities around the country. Did people, you know, show up in big numbers on the streets saying this is unconscionable, we don't agree, we're sticking with our unions?
It was exciting to see so many union members say, I believe in unions, I'm not leaving. And I think that got covered in the media, and that was exciting to see. I don't see yet the groundswell to, and I think part of that is the groundswell of kind of anger about this decision. And that might be because I think now there's a lot of consciousness raising that has to happen. I think the nation needs to really kind of come to grips with what it means to, first of all, why this ruling was so problematic, right? But also then what it means to decimate unions, what historically has been the role and what can be the role moving forward of unions, particularly of the public sector. Mm-hmm.
Kevin, in the last minutes of our conversation, let's take a look at a news story that has just come up as you and I are talking, that the Trump administration is unsurprisingly planning to rescind a set of Obama-era rules that attempted to offer guidance to colleges in their application process to use race as one factor of many. It's being sort of discussed as affirmative action. What do you make of these rules? What do you make of Trump's action to rescind these rules? What sort of impact could it have on colleges?
Yeah, I'm not surprised by the announcement that they'll rescind these guidelines. The Trump administration came out in support of plaintiffs who are challenging affirmative action at Harvard. I think the Obama guidelines or guidance on affirmative action really tries to clarify what the courts have said about the use of race in affirmative action admissions decisions. What the court has actually said over several decades, but affirmed in the Fisher versus University of Texas case a couple of years ago, is that race cannot be an overriding factor. In other words, there can't be quotas. It can't be kind of a bottom line. But race can be one of a set of factors in what's called a holistic review of students. If you look at a whole bunch of different things, race can be one of it. Why? Because diversity is important for the educational experience of students. That's the ruling of the courts. And so the Obama guidelines actually clarifies that. It says, just to be clear, race cannot be play an overriding role, but it can be one of a set of factors in holistic reviews. So that is actually what is at stake in the Harvard case. So it's the same organization, by the way, that rallied people and brought together plaintiffs to challenge affirmative action at UT Austin. All right, the same organization has brought together a group of Asian American students to be the plaintiffs in a challenge to Harvard's affirmative action admissions policies. And it's basically making to my understanding, the same argument it's been making before, that this is a violation of Title VI of the Civil Rights Act, and that it's discrimination basically on the basis of race. And race should not be a factor. And what the Harvard case argues is that there's some research that shows that if you only look at quantitative measures like test scores and GPAs, and you take away affirmative action, although it would hurt Black and Latino applicants, it would actually help white applicants, and it would particularly help Asian American applicants.
Right.
That's what one study has shown. So that's the basis of claiming that it's going to hurt, but on the basis of race. Now, what many of us have argued is that the problem with that argument is that it's basically presuming that a small number of quantitative measures like standardized test scores and GPAs should be the basis for deciding whether or not someone is qualified to get into a higher ed institution. Right. And I think given all we know about the limited scope of these kinds of measures, in other words, given all we know about how little they actually tell us about someone's capacity and achievement, I think we should be pushing universities to be even more robust in their admissions processes. Right. We should be looking at all sorts of factors in terms of what makes a student qualified and what kind of a student body you're trying to build. And diversity, absolutely. I think many of us would argue should be one of it. So I think that's kind of what's at stake in the Harvard case. I think that's how they're, by the way, using Asian Americans, as one scholar calls it, as racial mascots, really, for this very conservative agenda around race and equality. And I think that's why the Trump administration is also jumping on board with the court case, but then not surprisingly is soon to rescind the guidelines that basically clarified what the court has been ruling for a long time. It's going to be really interesting to see if this conservative court goes against what the Supreme Court ruled really just very, very recently about kind of the same arguments and the same challenges to affirmative action.
Hmm. Kevin, always a pleasure to have you on, and we always enjoy your analysis on these stories. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Kevin Kumashir is a former dean of the School of Education at the University of San Francisco and our education correspondent. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.